is amazing.
I didn't know nothing about it.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Say what you say, say what?
I don't want to be like Mike.
Before Magic's knees go permanently south for the winter.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Changing up the guard quicker than fear brings down doo-doo. Young bro.
He never saw Elgin Baylor play during his day or Oscar Robinson.
Flash the dice roll back. The big O was jackknifing through all them bodies.
I didn't know nothing about it.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the collision. This is usually the part where I say he's Etan Thomas, I'm Dave Zirin, the 11-year NBA vet, but Etan is doing the Lord's work today, speaking to young people in Brooklyn, New York. Big ups, Brooklyn. And I am here with none other than the coach, Kevin McNutt. And at 10:30, we got Modi himself, Chuck Modiano, who's going to be joining us from oh so far away, as ye shall hear. But First and foremost, we got you, Coach. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing beautiful, babe. I'm doing beautiful. Let's do this thing, man. I'm on short time myself. Let's go to work.
Let's go to work. And there's more than enough to speak about, not the least of which is something we've yet to talk about on this show, and that's the opening 10 games of the NBA season, which are rife with politics that we want to discuss right now. So Thrown it in your corner, Coach, where do you possibly want to begin?
Oh, man, come on. How can we not go with Nico Harrison? Let's get this ball rolling today, man. And I know you're full and ready to fire it up from three-point range. So go to work, man. Go to work.
All right, let's talk about this for a second. Nico Harrison is the recently fired general manager of the Dallas Mavericks. Now, what was Nico Harrison's great sin, you might ask, given that the Dallas Mavericks were in the NBA Finals as recently as 2024? Well, maybe it's because last January, he traded the franchise player, Doncic, to the, of all teams, Los Angeles Lakers, for a half-broken down Anthony Davis and Max Christie. We're going to talk about that. Now, this trade, to put it mildly, gutted the people of Dallas. It is being was called at the time one of the worst trades in NBA history. Luka Doncic at that time was 25 years old and had already at 25, Chuck, made five first team all NBA. Five. That is really wild. Now, I got to tell you, and at that point, he also was basically the king of Dallas. He loved Dallas. He wanted to stay there his whole career. People were already talking about what the statue would look like of him at Dallas. And Nico Harrison not only traded this franchise player, but he did not do a bidding war. He did not make it public to other teams. He did not see what the best possible deal could be. I mean, you could have gotten how many first-round picks for Luka Doncic? I mean,
three or four.
Five or six.
Right.
Seven or eight. And instead, using the argument that because Luka's body wasn't in great shape, that he was going to be prone for his body to break down as he got older, that was the main argument. They did not want to invest the largest contract in NBA history, which Luka was due for, down the pike. Now, that argument might even have a thread of logic to it. Luka was in not very good physical shape for a world-class athlete at the time. You know, to be say it modestly, for that matter. I mean, to undersell it. Not in the best shape, although obviously ruthlessly effective on the court. But he traded him for a player in Anthony Davis, who not only was 8 years older than Luka Doncic, but whose career of injuries is really unmatched among star players in the NBA. So that was the trade. And at the time, I got to give this background. What it sparked was something I personally had never seen. in NBA history, which was fans protesting outside the arena, fans even vandalizing the arena, and then fans being kicked out of the arena for having signs that said to fire the general manager, Nico Harrison. Now, we can talk into a moment about the ownership and why I think they bear a lot of responsibility for this. We can talk about that in a second.
Absolutely.
But I want to tell the narrative first. So that was the general argument for in January for why folks should fire Nico, why the team should fire Nico Harrison. People were just utterly beyond outraged. Fast forward to today. But Nico said, wait a minute, I have a blueprint for a championship in the next 2 years involving Anthony Davis and a hyper defense first team. Because Anthony Davis, when he does play, remember he's oft injured, is a world class defensive player. Fast forward to today. In the 44 games that Anthony Davis has been eligible to play, I want you to guess, coach, how many he's played because of injuries.
22.
Nine.
No, you're kidding me.
I am not.
I know you're not, but wow.
Nine out of 44. In other words.
Hey, by the way.
Yes, sir.
Hey, Dave, real quick. You also didn't mention that. Didn't Luka go to the finals before this trade?
Yeah, no, I said that. Yeah.
Oh, did you say that? Okay,
But that's important, too, because part of Nico Harrison's argument was that a team led by Luka Doncic was never going to win an NBA Finals.
Okay.
While they had been to the finals, and I want to yell this, but I'm going to burn out people's eardrums, just the previous year.
Yes, okay.
A wildly unintelligible trade that really just confused the basketball world, made even worse by the fact, my man, coach, that of all teams to trade Luka Doncic to, they choose the Lakers.
I know.
Hated Lakers.
Yeah. But anyway, I just want to interject. I didn't know you covered it. So you said he's made 9 of 44 games. What is that? That's a third or fifth.
Yeah, that's a fifth. Davis. You're absolutely right. And again, let me just say that the argument for trading Luka Doncic was, he'll get injured too much as he gets older. So this failed on every conceivable level. Now, fast forward to this season. Somehow Dallas got the number one pick in the draft, a very exciting young man named Cooper Flagg, 18 years old. The ironically, coach, I think he is the most highly touted American prospect since Anthony Davis.
I hear you. since Anthony Davis. But the key word you put in there is somehow, but that's another part of the discussion.
They had a 0.3% chance of getting that number one pick. Yeah, somehow they got it. That's a whole separate convo. I do believe in conspiracy theories when it comes to the NBA draft. So, I mean, because this team, which is in one of the largest markets in the NBA, I sometimes think us East Coasters don't realize how large the Dallas-Fort Worth market is. And this team just gets absolutely gutted. There are people chanting in the stands. There's fury. And then magically they get the number one pick. So enter this season. Nico Harrison is like, okay, he shows up at the first game and is like, proof of concept. Now you're going to see the vision. Well, guess what? The Dallas Mavericks are one of the worst teams in the NBA this year. They're 3-9. And guess what? Anthony Davis showed up out of shape.
Right.
There's an irony there, too, because the whole thing about Luka was that he's so out of shape. Not only does Anthony Davis show up out of shape this year, but Luka Doncic decides to spend the summer becoming Mr. Body Beautiful and is even on the cover of Men's Health magazine looking svelte going into this season. So you have like just this incredible scenario where a trade that at the time people said was might be the worst in NBA history, all of a sudden becomes even worse. Oh, and I have to add this too.
Go ahead.
Some people might say, well, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was traded from the Bucks to the Lakers. How about that for the worst trade in history? And to that, I want to say this, coach. First of all, I don't think it was as bad. Second of all, you know, the Bucks got some good players. Shout out Junior Bridgman. Mm-hmm. But not even talking about that coach. Kareem wanted out of Milwaukee. That's the big difference.
Yes, sir.
We've seen great players force their way out of situations where they were unhappy, as they should have every right to. Luka loved Dallas.
Yes.
And was as shocked as anybody. And they didn't give him a courtesy phone call. They never said it. I mean, just a lot of things that had everybody in the NBA saying, this is not how things are done. And I got to go back, coach, to the whole idea that there was never, they didn't even do a bidding war. They didn't pursue other teams. They didn't ask around. It was just to the hated Lakers, where, by the way, Nico Harrison used to be strongly connected to because he worked directly with Kobe Bryant. So nobody was happy into this. Now, people
Hold up, Dave. I got a question for you on that.
Yes.
What was his rationale or gibberish for why he said he didn't go other places to seek this trade and only dealt with the Lakers?
Great question, coach. Because he said that he only had one person he wanted for Luka Doncic, and that was Anthony Davis.
In the whole NBA?
In the whole NBA. Anthony Davis, who I don't think is a top 15 player this point in his career.
No, sir.
While Luka, to me, without question, is a top 3 player in the NBA, along with Jokic, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Throw Giannis in there. That's the big four to me in the NBA right now. Mm-hmm. So even with all of that, that was the rationale. I want Anthony Davis because I have a vision for a defense-first team that's going to win it all. Now, people like myself ran to conspiracy theories on this question like, wait a minute, the owner of the team is the Adelson family. Everybody says, oh, Patrick Dumont, he was the owner. He didn't know what he was doing. He gave all the power to Nico Harrison. Dumont doesn't know basketball. All of that might be true. But no one talks about the fact that Patrick Dumont is the son-in-law of Miriam Adelson, somebody who gave not only gave Trump $100 million, but somebody for his reelection, that's a whole separate issue. $100 million. Gee, you remember when campaign finance reform was a thing? Just write a 9-figure check to somebody. It's so funny to me that, you know, money in politics, you know, yes, limits, spending limits, donation limits. Oh, here's $100 million. You know, there really are no rules anymore. So when it comes to the wealthy, but Miriam Adelson's dream was to have the team as part of a casino. Now, where does Miriam Adelson own a ton of property and a ton of casinos? That would be Las Vegas.
Yes.
Where is the area that the NBA wants to expand to? That would be Las Vegas. So to me, my conspiracy mind was just like, they are trying to gut the fan base in Dallas, make them hate the team. And I don't, you know, whatever. Maybe I was right. Maybe I was wrong on that. But the most important factor in this that you and I need to understand and the listeners need to understand is that the situation just got too untenable for the Adelsons, too untenable for Patrick Dumont. And they pulled the plug on it yesterday. And this is a huge, huge story in the league. It's about corporate power. It's about expansion. And, but you know what it's most of all about, coach? It's about a fan base that through its own movement removed an executive from power a year and a half after they go to the NBA finals. Now that, sir, is something that you simply do not see. So that's the general contours of it as I see it at this time. Now, Miriam Adelson also is one of the people who's been told that she can form that Riviera in Gaza once they've removed all the people from there. And that people say, is that what she bought with that $100 million to Donald Trump? Because her politics are very much like pro, you know, get everybody out of Gaza and let's build ourselves the string of casinos. So just to say, you know, the Holy Land needs casinos. I don't know if you knew that. But, you know, because there's no vice in gambling, which might speak to another topic that we talk about. But it's just to say that this is the news in the NBA right now. The Dallas Mavericks have bottomed out. And the last thing I'll say about it is that this young man, Cooper Flagg, who should be considered the future of the NBA in many respects. I've watched him play. You've watched him play. I think he's the real deal. I think the talent is the real deal. I'd be curious about your scouting report on him, frankly. But to put him in a situation where he is on a team that the fans hate, that people were chanting, "Fire Nico," while Cooper Flagg was at the foul line in his second NBA game at home. You can't do that to that young man. He's 18 years old. You're going to not develop him correctly, or he's going to look for a way out. And, you know, that's just something that I think the ownership also said. We have a property, because, you know, they view these players as property. We have a property that is simply too valuable in Cooper Flagg, whether we want to move to Vegas or not, to let his actual game wither on the vine, because the vibe on the team is simply so terrible.
Couple of things there, Dave. You said booing him on the foul line. I think they were booing Nico. And
That's just me misspeaking. They were booing Nico, but to hear boos and to hear fire Nico when you're trying to shoot free throws and you're supposed to be Dallas's darling.
For goodness sakes.
I'll tell you something. A white man hasn't been treated that badly in Dallas since J.R. Ewing. Sorry, I had to throw that in there.
Happy audience to know who J.R. Ewing is, but I do. But anyway.
You know what? That joke was still a good joke. I don't even care.
I can dig it, brother. I can dig it, brother. I can dig it. But look, right, other thing about that. So Nico's gone, so I think they would say, okay, good. The guy who traded Luka, he's out of here. We're gonna rally around the team. We're gonna rally by a flag. Jason Kidd's still there. I got a lot of props from him. He's gonna mold Flagg. By the way, Flagg, just to show you how incredibly multi-talented he is miscast right now playing point guard. Now they made some changes to do that, but he opened up at point guard in his first game. I'm like, what are you doing at 6'8" being a point guard?
Well, 6'8"
coming to the league at 18. Yeah.
6'8" at least. He's still growing. And but just before we go on, because you follow the college game and the youth game more than I do, mm-hmm. do you agree with my assessment about this young man's potential?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The guy plays with a fire. He played. Look, I remember when he went to the Olympics and the big boys were saying, "Oh,
the trials." Yep.
Yeah, the trials. This guy's got the goods, and he did. And he did not disappoint. Duke lost, and they had four top 15 picks. So yeah. and they lost in the NCAA championship. They didn't get to the.
They lost in that final.
They lost in the semifinals, but it was not because of him. Right. Yes.
No, he was player of the year.
So it wasn't because of Flagg.
He was injured part of the year and still won all the player of the year awards. I mean, he's a very talented player.
Yep.
And you can't, and you know this from young people too. I don't care how strong of mind he is. An 18-year-old going into a situation like this is not good. You have to protect the talent.
So that's the broader
situation.
You mentioned that, worst trade since Kareem. Our friend of the program, David Aldridge, wrote that the trade was among the worst in sports, down there with the Herschel Walker trade between the Vikings and Cowboys. Ooh. You remember that?
Sure do.
And he went back to something that, I'm sure you know because you're – but the Boston Red Sox owner trading Babe Ruth to the Yankees for $100K in 1919.
Not only – look how much I know this history, Coach. I'm going to flex a little bit.
Oh, good.
It wasn't $100K. It was $125K. The owner of the Red Sox was named Harry Frazee. And the reason why he sold Babe Ruth's contract was to fund a Broadway musical. Now, real fans know even the name of that Broadway musical, which was No, No, Nanette. So there's the full story. Babe Ruth was sold for $125K. Baltimore's own Babe Ruth got to shout out our locals for $125K for the one and only Broadway musical, No, No, Nanette.
Boy, come on, man. You are fired up. You're hot today, boy. Feed Dave.
Made you look. A little Nas there. Made you look.
you walked to the gym today and said, what's the record in this joint? You know what I'm saying?
That's right. That's right. I'm looking at what the bench press is, and I'm not doing it. But I'm talking a lot of smack.
Right.
So,
right.
So that's the issue on a whole, Coach. But there's more. We spent some time on that. We know there's more stuff going on in the NBA that we need to discuss.
Yes. Yes. I'm going to ask you, because like I said, I'm going to have to fly here shortly. But I got a couple of questions for you real quick. And you touched on one. So I'm going to stay with that. I'm going to rearrange it and give you this one first. The NBA All-League First Five could be an All-International Five. So it's a twofold question. We're talking Luka, Giannis, Shai Gilgeous, Wimby, and Joker. Okay? Do you understand that? Do you see that? Is that a possibility? And part two, if you agree with that, give me an American player that could move into that top five.
You know what? I'm going to have a wacky answer for you.
Uh-oh.
First of all, I could not agree with you more that the top five players in the NBA are from places like France, Serbia, Croatia, Canada, Greece, you know what I'm saying? And who am I forgetting? I just named four, but you get my point. The player the player who I think can absolutely move in there, who's an American, was a second round draft pick out of really? Villanova.
Oh, Brunson.
By the name of Jalen Brunson.
Yeah, I knew that.
That might seem a little odd to folks, because you look at Brunson, you see a kid barely 6 feet tall. He's built like a mailbox.
500 mailbox, okay.
Dude's head is bigger than like remember Ted Kennedy, the size of his head? That's like Jalen Brunson's head. Just, you know, you got a very large-headed, very short young man who is a second-round draft pick. But let me tell you something about this young man. If the Knicks are the best team in the East by the end of the year, and if Jalen Brunson, who, and believe me, I'm saying a prayer right now, may have hurt himself last night, left.
Right, I watched.
Booth, but I'm hoping that's next to nothing. Mm-hmm. People might have that conversation if he averages like 29 a game and they go deep into it. And if one of the players you mentioned falls backwards, like, for example, last year, people would have put Luka maybe going into the season in the top two, but because of injuries last year and the ascension of Canada's own Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, he moved backwards on that. And, you know, and then both Shai and Giannis, who had just an incredible year last year, moved ahead of Luka, and you had to put him at number four. If one of those players falls backwards, and believe me, it's not going to be Victor Wembanyama, but if one of those players falls backwards, then Jalen has a shot. I mean, it's a 5% shot, definitely. But you asked about an American player, and I really have him at the top of my list. If Jason Tatum wasn't injured, he might be higher up there. But, you know, the era of Steph Curry, even though he dropped 46 points last night, you have to push him back. LeBron hasn't played a game all year, and good gracious, Coach, is way closer to my age than he is even to Shai Gilgeous-Alexander's age. How crazy is that?
Yeah.
And so you have to make that point.
Right.
He's closer to your age than he is to Victor Wembanyama's age. I mean, this is what we're talking about, Coach. With respect to you, man, because I respect my elders.
Well said, brother. But look, I was going to go to another question, but you hit me with that. I have no thing. Brunson is amazing, because what he's developed every year, because originally he's not the super athlete going to flying for dunks, and he's not going to break ankles and wow you with a crossover and all that kind of, but he just gets it done and gets it done. And I'm really watching progress every year, and he gets better and better and better. So I was thinking, what about Cade Cunningham? What's my man down in Minnesota? I'm drawing a blank right now.
Oh, you're talking about Anthony Edwards.
Yeah, although he's talking more than he's producing now.
I feel like he's too inconsistent.
Right.
I really do. While Brunson brings it every night.
Right.
And also, because the Eastern Conference is weaker, they'll give Jalen Brunson more credence if they finish at the top of the heap. And there's no way Minnesota's finishing at the top of that heap in the West.
Right. So, but what about Mitchell in Cleveland?
Mitchell impresses the heck out of me.
But not more than Brunson.
No, he doesn't.
Okay.
I mean, he just doesn't. And we could talk about why probably when we have more time. But while I adore Donovan Mitchell, to me, Brunson is a next level player.
Got you. I got a next question for you to follow up on that one. But I want to get your vibe on this one. Are the Lakers, the 8-3 Lakers, fast start, Luka's throwing up big numbers. By the way, I got to throw in another most improved player is Reeves. He has met
Austin Reeves. Austin, my goodness.
No, is it Austin Reeves?
Yeah, Austin Reeves.
Okay, yeah. He's elevated his game every year. I'm really amazed at what he's doing with it. He had a 41 and a 51 back-to-back piece.
Yes. Austin Reeves has the best nickname in the NBA right now.
What is that?
A Hillbilly Kobe. Because he plays in you know, his low post game actually has a lot of similarities to what Kobe was doing. Although he's not the physical and any physical person that Kobe was in terms of his body.
Slow down.
All right. I just said I like the nickname. That's all I said. No, that's all better. I said.
I've ref Kobe, and no, we're not doing that. But anyway.
Ooh, what a little name drop, Coach.
I mean, you went on that diatribe about 1990 and 125,000, so I thought I might, you know, I put myself a little pat on the back. But anyway.
Thanks.
So are the Lakers 8-3? That's a fantastic start for them, you know, with LeBron on the shelf. Who, by the way, I'm not so sure that's not, here I go again, that's not a good thing and wasn't in the cards. Like sciatica? Nobody's heard of that. So then he's missing 20, 25 games. He's going to come back. He'll be fresh for the run.
Perhaps, yeah. You know? I mean, although a lot, you're looking at it as in LeBron is the ultimate team player and staying out with his sciatica. For the purposes, and sciatica is no joke. So, right. So salute to LeBron. That hurts like heck. Although you don't usually hear of NBA players getting sciatica.
Exactly.
But I guess you play 22 years. You're entering your 23rd year.
Woo.
I mean, it defies description. You're entering your 23rd year in the NBA. And I don't want to hear anybody say, well, Tom Brady played till 45 because, you know, believe me, your quarter, and I know it's a dangerous sport. I know it's the NFL, but he's not playing defense.
No.
Although some would argue LeBron's not playing defense either. Hey-o! But the thing though that we got to remember too is that I don't think LeBron is being Mr. Team Player because there's a lot of word that he is not happy that the team is now, quote unquote, Luka's team. It's the first time in LeBron's 23-year career
that
the team is not LeBron's team.
You know what? And I try to tell people that. I said, you know, going from your team and giving up to somebody else is not a smooth transition. This is not Kareem going deferring to Magic, because Magic did that very politically, was savvy on how that transition went. You know what I'm saying? Most guys, that's a hard give up. To, you know, I'm the man, and LeBron's ego's as big as anybody else's, and now it's Luka's team, and he's got the ball 75% of the time, where I had it 75-25 versus anybody else. That's not easy. There's going to be some. Anyway, it's just not that easy. I can't say it any better than that. It's not easy.
It's not easy at all.
Yep.
So
the question is, before I bounce, is. Are the Lakers, where are they? Are they that team and that's going to get better once LeBron comes? Or is that team that took a 29-point thumping last night at OKC? You know, I'm sure it's somewhere in the middle, but is it more middle of the 8-3 or more middle of, you know, they're not going to be able to compete no matter
definitely
when?
Definitely more to the 8-3 level. I just don't think, you know, you've got this Oklahoma City team that's young, that's filled with players that want to prove themselves, and that has the aspiration of winning 70 games. Mm-hmm. And this is a league where we know not every team takes it seriously every single night during the regular season.
Yes, sir.
Now, here's a team that's a defending champion, that's still young, that's still hungry, and that wants 70 wins. And you're going to get a 29-point thumping sometimes.
Right. Okay.
That's my take.
And by the way, that was without Williams. That was without Williams, who still – what's his problem? Well, okay,
sure. He's still nursing the wrist that he played through the NBA Finals with. He dropped a 40-point game in the NBA Finals with a wrist that was basically hanging off on the bone. I mean, I know sometimes I have very mixed feelings about this because – you know, you play through injuries like that, you feel him your whole life, but then you also got to have respect.
Right.
For, right. You know, it's one of those things, you know, where if you like sports, you know that there's going to be a toll. But I digress. We've just hit the bottom of the hour, and okay. Coach, I know you've got to go. Mm-hmm. I know you've got an appointment to get your head shaved, which is great. All love to you, buddy.
Thank you, my friend.
Let's go to break right now here on The Collision on WPFW, your home for Jazz and Justice.
All right.
We are back here on the collision here on WPFW, your home for Jazz and Justice. And of course, The Collision is where sports and politics collide. Adios, Coach. Great to have you on the show, talking the ins and outs of Luka Doncic and the politics behind the worst trade in NBA history. And now we have on the line with us a very tan looking Chuck Modiano. Chuck, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. How about yourself, DZ?
Chuck, tell us where you are right now. Tell the listeners, because I'm in Maryland.
I'm in Thessaloniki, Greece, and I even wanted to make the back end of this show. So the background, you know, on the visual is Greece. It's beautiful here. You might have...
Oh, Chuck, freezing up just a little bit there, buddy. Ooh, we're losing Chuck just a little.
Okay. I would say Giannis is very big news here in Greece.
Oh, talk to me about Giannis. Talk to me about
Giannis. He's big. You know, you see billboards everywhere. He's big here. And, you know, I'm a social person, so I just make conversation with people. Most people that I've met do speak English. And we get an NBA conversations. You know, I got an NBA conversation with someone who loved the Clippers. And Lob City, we start talking about that. So I think a very small sample size, but there's a bit of knowledge here about American basketball.
Very cool indeed. I like the way that sounds. I really do. So what else is going on with you there, Chuck? I mean, the politics is what I'm interested in. What's the politics in Greece? We know that there has been a lot of protests around Palestine. We know that there has been a lot going on over there that we don't normally talk about, you know, in other places, you know what I'm saying? And like that we don't talk about in this country in terms of resistance. And so that's what I want you to bring to the table if you don't. Yeah.
Well, I don't know if I could bring all that to the table, but I could give you an anecdote that speaks to it. I wanted to tap into the protest crowd. I don't have time. I didn't have too much time. My nephew here is studying abroad, which was the impetus for me to come.
Okay.
Yeah. He's studying abroad, and then he's going to Ireland next semester. So we're going to go visit Dublin in the next week. And I am going to tap into the protest crowd in Ireland. And we know they have a robust protest crowd. But so I've been spending a lot of time, you know, with him and using this time to connect. But I want to give you one anecdote that really hit me. And it is the metro in Thessaloniki, Greece. And on the metro, if you buy a ticket, and that ticket, I think, is 60 euro, it'd be under a dollar euro. It'd be under a dollar in America. It'd be maybe, I don't know, 70, 80 cents, depending what the exchange rate is. And you get that ticket, and then you can use that ticket for 90 minutes. Go take any other metro for 90 minutes. But here's what happens. Most people finish their ride before 90 minutes, and if they don't need a connection, they leave their ticket at the base of the escalator. So on any given day, you could see a bunch of tickets at the base of the escalator, and riders coming down could just take a ticket. I took a ticket, I used it, and then I put it back on the base as long as it has time remaining. And what is interesting is that there's no police. People are aware of it. No one cares. And there's this radical idea that maybe that if someone's trying to get to work or get to go somewhere, it's a shared humanity. It's a shared responsibility. And I say that when I think about things like the National Guard in D.C., when I think under Trump, or the National Guard under Kathy Hochul sending them into New York City last year for New York City Fair Evaders, or my friend Afeni in D.C., who was mauled by a cop for alleged fare evasion, had a traumatic experience and had to stay in jail and was pepper sprayed and had pepper spray drenched over her for the alleged thought of fare evasion during the crackdown. And it just sometimes when I'm abroad, it hit me when I got sick abroad years ago in Macedonia, of how sick our country is, how so very sick. And it's such a sickness. And as much as I try to resist the sickness, and the root of the sickness is called capitalism, you could argue with the white supremacy and how they're intertwined. And it's so sick that even if you try really, really hard, you can't help but being infected yourself, no matter how much you try. And sometimes, almost every time I go abroad, I feel it. Oh, you mean the government is here not just for profit? It's here for humanity. At any moment in time, they could rip those tickets off the bottom of that escalator, take them away, but they don't. There's an understanding that maybe, you know, transportation to get to where you want to go is sort of a human right. And if somebody's poor and if somebody's broke and it's a very, you know, there is a lot of poverty here, that a person could wait 5-10 minutes and get a free ticket to go on the metro. So I'm going to leave it at that, DZ. But
sounds like really what Sohran Mamdani is talking about for New York City in some respects.
Yeah, and it's not radical elsewhere. Words like socialist are radical only in America, and elsewhere it's like, oh, you mean helping each other out? It's called humanity.
Well, Chuck, do you remember the mass 2014 protests in Brazil? Sao Paulo and in Rio that eventually became turned onto the World Cup because of the money that was going into the World Cup. And, you know, I made jokes at the time that Brazilians protesting soccer is like us New Yorkers protesting pizza. But but the actuality of that, though, is the root of that protest was the buses in Sao Paulo, which had historically always been free. They asked for an extremely modest payment. Now, what I loved about that was they understood that a small payment just breaks the social compact. It doesn't matter if they were asking for a fingernail to get on the bus. It was breaking a social compact that working class people took very seriously, which was the idea that you didn't have to fumble through your pockets. You didn't have to reach through the holes in your wallet. You could get from point A to point B in one of the most massive cities on earth, Sao Paulo, just because that was the social compact at play. And that's what spurred those protests that eventually got steered onto the World Cup. So a fascinating display on that front as well. People, I think, don't realize if you live, say, in the suburbs maybe, or in the rural areas or in the exurbs, how in a rural environment, you know, I mean, I'm sorry, how in an urban environment, public transportation can be the difference between life and death. And honestly, like the Purple Line near where I'm living is also about understanding that people can't really, working class people can't even afford to live in the cities at this point. So you got to find a way for people to be able to get into the city so they can work from the suburbs, which are experiencing rises in poverty as rents rise in the cities themselves.
That's right. Well said, DZ. Well said. Yeah.
So I got to ask you this, only because it's in the news and we haven't discussed it yet. The news in the United States right now is being roiled, and I mean roiled, by the revelations around the Jeffrey Epstein emails and the connections with Donald Trump that we all have known, we all have suspected, we all have seen, but to see it being written out means it's getting the attention from what up till now has been a cowed mainstream media. Is that news getting out there? And then I have a follow-up question for you.
I don't know if I'm qualified to say if the news is getting out here because I haven't really spoken to so many people about that. So it's a good question. I'm sorry. I don't know the answer to that. I just do know, I mean, it's about time. I'm of the opinion that getting Epstein off of the topic is part of the reason for the Washington, D.C. invasion by our military and troops. I'm not alone in that thinking. So, you know, let's get back to holding power accountable.
Because that's what it's really about.
Yeah, right? Let's get back to holding real criminals accountable.
Because that's what it's about, because it's about the fact that, you know, we live in a country, to quote the great socialist presidential candidate Eugene Debs a century ago, we live in a country, and I am paraphrasing, that is like a magical fishing net that catches all the minnows while the whales flow right through it. And I think this is a situation where, you know, where this country has been, I shouldn't say all of this country, but swaths of this country have been willing to excuse, like, the shooting of children in our schools and said, well, that's just the price for the Second Amendment. I mean, I think right now, speaking about the, not just the abuse of children, but the way it was a fundamental practice of the wealthy and powerful, is something that's actually breaking through the noise. And to see it reflected on a president who basically comes off like a supervillain these days anyway, you know, holding, you know, like cutting food for people, the food on their plates to survive while he's throwing great Gatsby parties and wrecking the White House. I mean, with a
great Gatsby parties. I've always liked your metaphorical abilities, DZ. Yeah.
No, that's not my turn of phrase. It was called a great Gatsby party.
Okay. There it is.
Truth, man, truth is stranger than the turn of phrase.
That's right.
But one of the things that's really rocking me on, Chuck, and I wanted to raise this with you to see if this has penetrated your mind in terms of this analysis, is that Drop Site News, which is very respectable, this is not a conspiracy site. It's run by Jeremy Scahill, who's won every award in journalism. It's run by Ryan Graham. Whose history has gone from the mainstream of media in his career towards a more resistance type position, pushing back against the tide of the media. They have done a lot of reporting about Jeffrey Epstein's connections with the Mossad and with the Israeli government.
Yes.
Now, this speaks to the question of Israeli policy in the United States, and was it influenced in any way, shape, or form by the idea of blackmailing people who were filmed while at Epstein Island? And this is the sort of thing that I would have dismissed as abject conspiracy, even as recently as weeks ago. And now it's the thing that I think we have to take seriously for two reasons. One, I was raised with the idea that you could explain the U.S. lockstep support for Israel, no matter the war crimes in Israel. I thought, you know, some people have explained that in ways that are frankly anti-Semitic. The way I have always understood it is that, one, it's a product of U.S. imperialism in the Middle East. You know, they want to have a masthead in the Middle East. They want to have control of the Middle East. And having like this military garrison state in the middle of the Middle East willing to do their bidding is a key part of controlling the oil of the region. That's one of the ways I've understood it. The second way I've understood it is that the United States is a country built on settler colonialism, as is Israel. So you have the commonality of that history. You know, the same way Northern Ireland and Ireland has a commonality with the history of South Africa, of the black population of South Africa under apartheid. So, you know, the commonality of them as countries that resisted empire and imperialism, as you will see, created bonds between Ireland and South Africa that are unbreakable, and Ireland and Palestine that are unbreakable.
That's right.
Similarly, I always thought not only was it about U.S. imperialism in the Middle East, but the commonality of settler colonialism and the racism that flows from that. was something, and the genocide and the excuse right. of genocide, it was something that, and displacement, you got to say displacement, was one of the things that led to that commonality. And now, Chuck, that's always been my analysis.
Yeah.
And now I'm wondering, well, what if it's not just that, but it's also because the wealthy and powerful in this country are being blackmailed by the Mossad.
Yes.
And it's shaking up my analysis, frankly, of the last 30 years of U.S. foreign policy. And then this is the last thing I'll say about it. You will never find me saying a good thing about George H.W. Bush, the president of this country from 1988 to 1992. But I will say this about George H.W. Bush and his Secretary of State, George Shultz. On multiple occasions, they suspended arms sales to Israel. Multiple occasions. And think about that. That might not even sound like much. Oh, so temporarily suspension of, but they did it as a way of sort of cracking the whip on Israel and saying, what you're doing to the Palestinian people is actually hurting our ability to function in the Middle East.
That's right.
Not because they love the Palestinian people, but they were willing to say to Israel, you are the dog on our leash.
That's right.
And we are going to discipline your behavior. That was a function of George Shultz when he was Secretary of State. Now, who becomes the president after George H.W. Bush? That would be Bill Clinton.
Barack Obama. Oh, the first one, Bill Clinton.
H.W. Yeah, we got to keep our Bushes in line. Yeah. Who was the president after George H.W. Bush? Bill Clinton. Who was a regular on Jeffrey Epstein's plane? Bill Clinton. When did the policy toward Israel become one where even the discussion of the suspension of arms sales was a political death wish in terms of how AIPAC would go after you? Bill Clinton.
That's right.
And so some of this is lining up in a way that is really making my hackles go up, not only because it's so amoral, but because it's also making me question a lot of my own perceptions about why the policy has been as deadly as it's been for the last three decades.
Mm. So that's a lot. And I'm
sorry.
Don't be sorry. It's a very important discussion and one I agree with, but I don't think it's changing so much as adding to your analysis, which is the same analysis I had. And first of all, one of the reasons Ireland, which I'm going next week, has the history is that people have to understand if they've heard of the Irish famine, it wasn't an Irish famine. It was Irish genocide. Not going to get into it here. I'll let people more qualified get into it. But they understand genocide. They understand colonization as well. And so some of that history that you see from those, and I mean those with an Irish accent, not those second, third generation who come to America and assimilated into whiteness, but those who may understand their history. There's that. But there's always been no pillars, and in some way I'm going to be a little redundant with you, when we're talking about the power of Israel. And the first pillar is the military-industrial complex. In many ways, the United States pays rent to have missiles and arms there to generally bomb Muslim people, but not only Muslim people. And that was somewhat the arrangement. Joe Biden has spoken to this in some famous quotes, in that there wasn't an Israel, we would have to invent one. So there's that. That's the military-industrial complex. Then you have AIPAC, which is the Israeli lobby. I don't think I need to go into detail of their incredible influence over politicians. And then what gets less attention is CUFI, the Christians United for Israel, which is actually bigger than AIPAC and really focuses on Christians. On the head of CUFI is John Hagee, a pretty white supremacy character. I'm not going to get into that either, that Christian Zionism and Mike Huckabee and the people are waiting for Armageddon and the rapture and Jesus Christ to come back, to where Jews are pawns in this affair and and Israel is just a big pawn in itself. And that's very scary as well. And then what you bring to bear is blackmail. And you're not the first to bring this to bear and talk the Mossad. Many people have said, I'm actually of this belief. And I believe we have to absolutely investigate Epstein. And not only that, we have to investigate Charlie Kirk's murder from an Israeli perspective as well. This is not Chuck Modiano spewing stuff. Lawrence Wilkerson, who is a former chief of staff and worked with the Secretary of State, I believe under a couple presidents, he is saying the same thing. There are former officials who work at the highest level of United States government who are saying, I do not believe Tyler Robinson did that. Didn't you see how fast he disappeared? Or they're saying Tyler Robinson did not act alone. We need to look deeper into this. Okay. Look at the crime scene that was ripped away the next day. There wasn't an autopsy. There were multiple people who were arrested before him. Donald Trump was in the news blaming the left before there was anyone apprehended. I'm of the belief that Tyler Robinson, just some sloppiness, even if he did it, could get off legally with a fair judge. But if he even did it. But my point is that we need an investigation, because there is a lot of blackmail that is going on, and it's not far-fetched, and there are people inside of government who are saying what we're saying. So what I think needs to happen are some serious investigations. Who can conduct those investigations? I don't know. Who can be independent? I don't know.
That's the best question. You know, frankly, the only people I trust to be independent are women. And because if you look at it, the people who are even on the right, the people trying to find out what happened on Epstein Island are actually female politicians. This is one of those situations where I'm going to go full 1,000% feminist on you, where I just do not trust men with regards to Epstein Island. We'll see what happens there. But by the way, shame to every Democrat that's giving people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Nancy Mace the high horse on this issue and on the issue of Israel as well, as Marjorie Taylor Greene has taken leadership on that. Shame on them for providing a leadership vacuum on the human rights catastrophe of our lifetime. You know, Chuck, I can't let you go, Chuck, without saying, you know, I just returned from Dublin and Belfast.
Yeah.
And I pray, I really do, that when you're in Dublin, you somehow find the time, even if you have to wake up very early, to do a couple hour drive to Belfast.
I'm going to Belfast too.
All right.
Already done.
You have to go to the wall of graffiti pieces that celebrate the people of Palestine and the historic connection between Ireland and Palestine.
I'm going to do that.
Must be seen.
It's already on the agenda. Not only is that on the agenda, it's already on the agenda because we think alike. But there's a George Floyd mural both in Belfast and in Dublin. And I'm going to go to both, but I'm going to try to do one better. I'm going to try to get people who were familiar, who were around that time in 2020, to give context in an interview. I think you know, in the next couple of years, I'm trying to get a George Floyd 2020 documentary out that was done in covering D.C. But I would like, while I'm here, to get a little bit of an international perspective as well.
And I'll also tell you that the wall that I'm telling you about that celebrates the connection between Ireland and Palestine also has just incredible murals dedicated to the black struggle in the United States, including a Muhammad Ali that'll make you cry. And so this idea of seeing the common, not only seeing the commonality of the oppressed, but celebrating it. Yeah. In a way that's artistic and beautiful and loud is something that I will never forget from my travels over there. And it's why I'm so desperate to come back, to go back. So take some photos for me. Say hi to all the right people. I hope you see friend of the program, Rebecca O'Keefe.
Will do. That's happening.
And send Rebecca our bet. Tell her we can't wait to have her back on the show. We're just about running out of time. Any last words, Chuck, for everybody out there?
I'm not going to say stay frosty. That's for you. But I'm just really excited to be abroad and find out some of the international connections. And what I would say, if you can, if you have the means, and I'm balling on a budget right now, serious budget, and you can, actually, if you get out of the country, it's so
huge.
Much easier to see the ills that is American society. It smacks you in the face.
Very, very well put. The perspective, I wish everybody could afford it. And as you said, scrape the money together if you can. It's worth it. Two shout outs, please. First and foremost, next Wednesday on WPFW, we're going to do a day in solidarity with the Sudan and all African peoples who are right now being subject to all kinds of ill will. And we're going to be part of that on the Collision at 11 a.m. next Wednesday. And also, you know, for just from my heart to our normal producer, Mike Nasella. Love you, Mike. Love you, Mike, from the top of my head to the bottom of my toes. For everybody out there listening, please stay frosty. We are out of here. Peace. And if
Once upon a time in the little Middle East, there was a fascist settler entity on a killing spree. They pillaged the innocent villagers to steal their dignity. It's simple, this literal misery's a thrill to industry. In case you're wondering, the place is Philistine. From little Italy to Greece and the streets of the Philippines, they know the name, even Algeria felt the guillotine, because ignorant idiots sit and wish to bring them to their knees. When it's like that, they even kill children holding white flags. It's quite mad, clear the only choice is to fight back. No, we are not scared, no, you cannot kill us. Resistance forever on behalf of those not with us. A moment of silence for DJ Khaled. It's clear the counterculture is forming, they seek to harm it. I bet they fear this verse and the words that the people chanted more than the songs charted from feeble, deceitful artists. This is, you can call it what you want, listen. This is more than just a song, listen. People aching to be free, this is more than faces on TV, listen. When we shut down your factory is, and shut down the university is, your politics is too cordial. It's intifada if your genocide's the new normal. Once upon a time across the cities of the West, millions were stressed to see civilians oppressed by billions invested in these industries of death. They tried to talk, but the politicians didn't seem impressed. With horrid lies, try to remove me from Spotify, but the bottom lines, I refuse to be colonized. Go against the system, can jeopardize your salary. Call us the generation that terrorized the factory. Shit, Kendrick and Drake wouldn't know there was a genocide. You would think for
peace. I'm DJ Underdog, inviting you to join me on Black Star Radio Mondays, 10 p.m. to midnight, beginning April 19th. We share the hottest sounds out of Africa from all corners of the motherland and bring you the sound of the African underground to DC and all points in between. Together, we'll explore African genres from Amapiano, Genge, Coupe de Calle, Zouk, Lingala, Ethiopian hits, Soukous, Nigerian hits, Egyptian hits, and Afro beats. The destination is Africa, Africa. And the mission is oneness. Journey with us Mondays at 10 p.m. right here on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time. Peace. 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 Peace.
Code Pink, Women for Peace is coming to you live from Washington, D.C. and New York City, Thursday at 11 a.m. Code Pink Radio is an energizing new program focused on ending wars and militarism and building a peace economy. Listen weekly to robust conversation and inspiration from grassroots peacemakers from places like Korea, Yemen, Venezuela, Palestine, and Iran, as well as peacemakers in our nation's capital who are confronting war hawks in the White House and in Congress and modeling the actions we want our government to take. Again, that's Code Pink Radio, Thursdays at 11 a.m. on Washington, D.C.'s WPFW and New York City's WBAI, an engaging hour of cutting-edge conversation not to be missed.
We are women of the world. We're from the east, south, north, and west.
No social justice issue or movement can escape the spotlight of the Latino Media Collective. The Latino Media Collective delivers consequential coverage from the biggest countries in South America to the smallest enclaves of Central America and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW Studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW Washington.
WPFW presents Amplify Sudan, Wednesday, November 19th. A day of emancipatory, informational, and inspirational programming centering Sudanese sovereignty and the ongoing threat to peace and security for her people. From 5 a.m. until midnight, there will be discussions with activists, journalists, and the people most impacted by what's happening in Sudan, in addition to the presentation of music and poetry centering Sudan. That's Amplify Sudan, Wednesday, November 19th, 5 a.m. until midnight, on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
أرض الخير أفريقيا مكاني زمن النور.
And this is W.